So I've curated a list. And by curated, I mean I went to the website of our former employer and looked at the front page and then wrote down every word that gave me some amount of rage. And so I accidentally wrote this list down in the order of the amount of rage that it gives me. So we will start. Number one, my first word is dynamic.
Okay. That was not what I was expecting, but that's a good one. Dynamic is very, it's such a buzzword because it a lot of people, they don't even really think about what it means. It's just sort of like it sounds kind of, well, dynamic. It sounds like you're doing something.
Exactly. It sounds like you're doing something. It sounds like you're changing.
Yeah. And
you are putting something into existence.
The funny thing about dynamic is that I think at one time it really did mean something like sort of cutting edge, because like back in the 90s, at least in the technical sense, you had static web pages were sort of the dominant type of web content, where you go to a page and it was basically like a file that was just sitting there. It didn't change unless somebody on the server side, went in and changed it or changed on some kind of schedule. But like a dynamic page would be, that's really kind of what we expect now. Like if you go to, for example, apple.com, and you can scroll through pictures of things and you can, mouse over things and change, and they respond to what you're doing. And, there's a dynamic sort of movement of content and, HTML and CSS and JavaScript going on there. JavaScript really was the key enabler of the dynamic web, because without JavaScript you can't, mm-hmm. you're pretty bare bones. JavaScript is such a great example of something terrible that became so ingrained that we just can't get rid of it because it was.
A lot of the coders I know.
Well, it was created in 2 weeks. It was a rush job, and it was meant to, I think the purpose of it was, it was to get out some competitor to some other thing that was out there already. And of course the name was terrible too, because it actually has nothing at all to do with the Java programming language, which I think was was popular at that time. And you would have what were called Java applets, like if you played games on yahoo.com, that was sort of a pre-Facebook kind of way to hang out with people, was to go to yahoo.com and play these different online games, and they all ran in Java, exactly. And so JavaScript was, it was a rush job, but then it was timed just right that every major site was like, well, now we got to invest in this, because otherwise our site could look so bad. And then by the time within a matter of not very long, it was like, well, now we can't undo this. It's sort of like this is baked into the fabric of the web, to mix metaphors a bit, right. And but then of course there's so many resources that have been devoted to making JavaScript run better. But
so I think one of the things that I noticed about my list, and I think dynamic is a good example of this, is that all of these words mean something, and they could mean something, right? They could mean a lot of things, but the content marketing industry has kind of consumed them enough that and dynamic is one of those words. You just gave a really succinct, very good explanation of where the dynamic internet came from, but the dynamic as a word in the content marketing industry means literally,
yeah, it's pretty meaningless,
right? Because they're always talking about you need dynamic content to give to your, what does that mean? What does dynamic content mean? In a real world sense, it means that you are always, I don't know. You would think that it means you're giving your readers something to read, something new to read very often. You have scheduled blog posts. You do lots of different kinds of content. But in the real, in the real sense of working in the content marketing industry and having to deliver quote unquote dynamic content, it means nothing.
I know I remember learning in my Greek class that, dynamic comes from the word dunamis, which means power.
Now, see, that's gorgeous. That's beautiful. That means.
Yeah, but I mean, it's sort of funny because, I mean, as it's sort of evolved in English, it's become pretty meaningless, except for like in that sort of narrow technical sense where you talk about dynamic, which, and it's funny because, I mean, I feel like calling what's on a web page content is somehow, it kind of makes sense in a way that calling like creative stuff content doesn't, or it doesn't arc me in the same way. Because like you say, well, you have all this dynamic content, and by that we mean like, you know, all these scripts and everything that are running, and you're loading the page with, you know, different, you know, text or pictures or whatever. That sort of seems like content in a way that like, well, this dynamic content, i.e. this white paper, you know, kind of, you know, that kind of irks me in a way that like calling a website dynamic content would not.
Well, because it's descriptive, right? Like you are actually describing the backend processes of that website. It means something. But a dynamic white paper, oh my God, those three words, what does that even mean? Like it means literally nothing. It means that someone was paid not enough to write 3,000 words to make it seem like your website like has value. Like,
yeah, I know. <that's>... I mean, dynamic is a filler word. I'm trying to think. It's sort of like job posting speak is sort of like where you have like, you know, you see a job posting and it's all stuff like, you know, detail oriented. I'm trying to think of some other ones that are so common, or self-motivated, or you know, stuff like that, where it's sort of like, I mean, it's almost not even meant to be taken literally. It's just sort of like, you know, they have to put it in there.
You have to speak the language, like speak the script, and like, yeah.
My first one was one that I actually I got this from when I was watching BoJack Horseman, where one of the characters goes to Vietnam, and you know, she, one of her jobs there, she's writing for some like, you know, digital publication. This episode came out in 2014, which would have been like sort of, I mean, really at the apex of what I would call like the, you know, the SEO content mill. The search engines had not completely wised up to this game yet. I mean, they were still like, if you were writing, things like the top, you know, X ways to, you know, get to the cloud from on-prem or something like that, or that type of Upworthy stuff where it was like, this guy, you know, retired at age 55, you'll never believe what happened next or something. And then something like that. So that was still there. And then like, you know, importantly, things like, you know, TikTok didn't exist yet. A lot of people were not really into video streaming services in general, so there was still a lot more text consumption going on, and so the word I was thinking of was clickable content. One of the lines in the episode is, "Hey girl, just checking up on that clickable content you're working on," and this phrase really like kind of, you know, horrified me in a way, because it did, you know, resonate, because I mean, even though we were writing, I mean, you know, it felt like we were just like generating garbage, but in some sense, we were, I mean, this was meant to be read by someone. It was always kind of nebulous who was going to read this. Like, it was sort of like, you know, the stock answer was, you know, a small business, you know, person or something.
Small business customer.
Yeah. It was never a large business customer. I mean, if it was, you would always, well, sometimes you get enterprise, you'd say it'd be for enterprise or something. But yeah, so I mean, clickable content, it's something like some, and even the name sort of has like a, like the sort of bait and switch is embedded in the name. It's sort of like somebody sees that and they're supposed to click on it, but then when they get there, it's just a bunch of trash, you know. It's like, I mean, if I had to think of like the, well, there's so many, you know, examples of this. Like, I mean, the type that we probably generated the most were sort of blog posts with these sort of, you know, catchy headlines with, you know, the best ways to, you know, upgrade to Wi-Fi 6 or something. Or
you had to put at least two keys.
Yeah, I mean, the headlines themselves had keywords. So even if they weren't, like organically, attractive, they would still rope people in because they would rank highly on the page. So you would get to page one and you would see some, you know, headline that had all these keywords in it, and then you would, you would think, well, yeah, maybe this has the answer, and then you go there, and well, it probably doesn't. So, yeah, it
probably
so
doesn't.
Let's so it's sort of a bait, yeah, bait problem. And switch, and I don't know if that, I mean, but this sort of lives on, even though I mean, like I said, that episode came out 10 years ago. I mean, like recipes are what I would call it clickable content, because you'll be like, you know, I don't know, pasta recipe, and then you look at it, and then like the first one, you get to a recipe, and you know, there's just this incredible, you know, prelude to it. You know, it's sort of like, you know, the like a video game cutscene, like the text is scrolling up or something, and then the recipe is like way down at the bottom. Yeah,
way down at the bottom, and then it's also like covered by the video that you have to.
Like, I think people have literally made like plugins and stuff that try to like defeat this like technique, because it's so it's so ubiquitous and so irritating. So it's so irritating. And I think the I mean, the reason they're so long is because the pages can generate more ad revenue if they have, you know, more text before the recipe. Because otherwise, you'll get there and you'll sort of just bounce right away, because you
you
won't have enough dwell time on the page. Yeah, so that's right. That's another metric that they used to always dwell upon was dwell time.
You know what this makes me wonder is like. Because we're generating clickable content, and that was 2014. When did the term clickbait become like ubiquitous? Because like basically, clickable content has a positive connotation, but clickbait has a negative connotation. And the thing is that they're the same thing. So I wonder how that evolved.
I don't know either. It's sort of clickbait, I think of that as sort of rising with Facebook in particular, because for a long time Facebook was a huge promoter of Upworthy, you know, that which was a site, you know, that had all those headlines like, you know, that you won't believe this, and you know, this brought
this dog almost died in the middle of the road.
Yeah,
guys, you'll never guess what happened.
Stuff like that. So Facebook, I mean, and of course Facebook has changed so many times. Like now, you know, I mean, once they emphasize or de-emphasize something, it just totally changes how much, you know, it really is a stark difference in how much traffic a site can get. So, I mean, back then, you know, the thing that Facebook promoted relentlessly were these types of articles with these, you know, irresistible headlines, you know, and then you had like listicles became a thing too. And so, I mean, I think that
listicles were big during my tenure.
Yeah. So it was, I want to say it's a social media thing, because I can't remember much in the way of clickbait before like Facebook existed, because, you know, back before that, the internet was sort of more of a, it was much more just like sort of like magazines and newspapers on screen. It was just sort of like, you know, all the conventions of the old, you know, ways of doing a print had carried over. But then with social media, you started to see it, I think, more of a divergence where, you know, it was more like, you know, you were supposed to get their attention right away with these, you know, click with the headline. And then if they went to the page, it didn't really matter. I mean, it mattered if they stayed and read, but just the fact that you could say you had this many visits or, you know, this many views, like that in itself was also valuable in a way that, like, you know, if a newspaper wrote like a clickbait headline, you know, 20 something years ago, somebody sees that and they might pick up the newspaper, but then they can immediately see that maybe it's not what they were expecting, and they put the newspaper back down. So yeah, it's one of those things that doesn't really work in the analog world.
Right. Click is like one of those metrics that they look out for, but a click doesn't necessarily mean.
Yeah, I mean, a click is, it's one of those things I think that is meant to just sort of, you know, to juice numbers. You know, they can say to like their investors or their, you know, board that, you know, we got X number, you know, site views or this amount of traffic, you know. So, and then that in itself is seen as valuable, even if it really doesn't translate into anything.
Well, speaking of which, my second word is data-driven with the hyphen. And I think, so my list is kind of it's a mix of like keywords, business speak, things that really I'm tired of saying and tired of thinking about.
Yeah.
And data-driven is one of those, because everybody cares about data. Everybody wants to know all about the data. And like we were just talking about, like, some of these metrics mean
nothing.
And so we have a data-driven optimization strategy.
Yeah.
You know, and what's the data?
Yeah.
Clicks. Oh, really?
Everything. Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's so true. Data-driven is, it's one that I'm trying to remember the first time I heard this, but I think it's probably like back in when Uber was sort of just first taking off, like maybe in the early 2010s. They were always like, we have a data-driven approach to pricing or something like that, you know, and yes. I mean, the whole thing about data is that, I mean, I think what, I mean, I'm sure you have your own sort of interpretation here, but my interpretation when I hear data-driven is that somebody is saying that, like, well, there's sort of this subjective, fluffy way of doing it, and this is the opposite of that. Like, you know,
this is the hard
stuff. This is the hard stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's very timely. Like, earlier, actually, I found a Mastodon post that was from someone that I can include this, you know, later in the show notes, but it said that data is never raw or unprocessed or neutral or objective. The decision to record a thing and not others, the structures and data formats it's pressed into, the granularity and frequency of collection are already a curation and interpretation of the world. A data set with unclear collectors without a declaration of the original purpose and goals is basically unusable in a responsible way. So, yeah. I mean, it's sort of like there's another sentiment that's like, you know, if something is objective, it's like basically something that nobody is listening to or working with, because if you introduce any person to the process, it becomes, you know, subjective inherently. Subjective.
Yeah. That's a really interesting way of looking at that. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it seems like when you, you know, I mean, like even in higher ed, right? Like I work at a university, we talk about, well, we need to make sure that the courses that we're offering follow a data-driven strategy.
Yeah. Right? So, I mean, that's,
first of all, gross. Second of all,
yeah. The funny thing about the,
you know, what's the data and who is the,
yeah. I'm always interested in what they mean, like when they say like they're doing a data driven, you know, evaluation of like which courses to keep and which courses to cut, because a lot of times the courses that colleges want to cut are actually the ones that are the most profitable, because like the humanities courses, like, you know, like English and foreign languages and so on. Because those, I mean, they have very little infrastructure cost, because you don't have to pay for any type of lab, or there's no labs, equipment. The textbooks are cheap. You know, the relevant texts are often, you know, public domain. So like, I mean, right. it's, and then so you have very low costs, and then but people still sign up for them, you know, in droves. So it ends up having a very, you know, high profit. Whereas like your STEM courses, you know, they're often, I mean, they have very high like fixed costs. So, and then
we just built a new statistics building place, and there's like a whole studio full of what do they call that, the hoods for soldering, right? Like,
yeah,
there's so much extra cost that's baked into those classes.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they go so all in on soldering and stuff, it's sort of like, I don't know, I feel like sometimes the obsession with STEM is sort of some kind of pining for the, like, industrial past, like where, you know, people were, like, working in the factories all the time and stuff, and somehow they want to get back to that, even though it would be kind of a, you know, a step down in living standards, most likely.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. Like the reverence that I see for STEM, and of course I work in an IT department, so there's always, you know, that kind of background noise. But like it's really interesting and kind of disheartening, honestly, sometimes. Because I mean you were a classics student, right? And I was an English student, so like,
yeah. I mean, it's just a different like idea people have. I mean, they think that everything has to be immediately transferable into some kind of job.
Hard.
Yeah, and even so, I mean, if you want to really be literal about that, like, I mean, the most transferable, I mean, the most hard skill that a lot of universities teach is like their language departments, because either, you know, English or things like, you know, foreign language, because those are skills that you will literally use like every day. And they're so basic to communicating. And so those are really hard skills, but people think of that as sort of somehow soft. But then they think that somehow, you know, knowing how to balance an equation or, you know, do some, you know, kind of advanced like physics, modeling is somehow something that everybody needs to know how to do. It's really not the case. I just don't see it as a universal skill in the same way. It's sort of like, at some point, I can't remember who said this. It was like, the thing about how everybody needed to learn how to code. Well, it's sort of like, I don't know. Does everybody know how like fuel injection works in a car? I mean, because it's like, it's sort of a similar thing where you have this mechanical infrastructure that's sort of important to a lot of things, but it's not really incumbent upon you to know how it works. I mean, you can figure it out maybe, or you can study it if it interests you, but it's not something that you need to know necessarily to get value out of the thing.
Do you know where that is? It's because we live in a society, and there are some people who
have that skill.
I don't have to have that skill.
Yeah, I know. For some reason, I just thought of that's true, because that's the whole point of living in a society. You don't have to do everything yourself. And I just thought of that stupid, like, there's like a really classic cartoon where there's like a peasant carrying like a bale of hay, and he looks like he's really, you know, suffering. He says, we should improve society somewhat. And then like this guy pops up out of like a well nearby, and he's got a spark on his face, and he says, and yet you participate in society. Very curious. And it's supposed to be like, you know, he's like the ultimate gotcha, you know, curious. Like.
We should include that in the show notes, because that's
I can find it. But it is really good, because people will say stuff like, you know, they'll say something like, well, the processes of iPhone production are maybe, you know, somewhat unethical. They'll say, and yet you're using an iPhone, you know? And so it's sort of that taking to the extreme, you know? It's like, you know, we should improve.
I hate your
process. We should improve society somewhat. Yeah, you're just incredibly mild. And then, anyway, then.
Oh man, it's like the ultimate like gotcha guy.
Oh, yeah,
the well actually Reddit person.
Yeah,
but yes, okay. Data driven
check mark.
So,
okay, this one is a totally different tack. Content management system. You may know this as CMS. I mean, oftentimes it is abbreviated as that, and people don't even think about what it stands for. But
They don't have to. It doesn't mean anything. Yeah.
So a content management system is basically, you know, it's an interface. It's usually like a web interface where, you know, you can enter, you can add, delete, modify various stuff on your website. So when we worked at the Content Mill, we had one of these, and it was built. It was totally bespoke.
It was
non-standard. So if you even had experience with any other type of content management system, it wouldn't help you, because it was totally its own. Like I said, it was totally bespoke. It had like a text. It kind of looked like what you would expect. Some common examples of content management systems that people might have used are things like WordPress, or Drupal is kind of an older one.
Lots of people that I know use Drupal. I think Drupal is a higher ed. Lots of higher eds use Drupal.
So, I mean, content management systems usually are very, they're pretty heavyweight. They have like lots of features. So they have things like, you know, you have your basic bold, italic, underline. They have, you know, different ways to offset text, add links, add media, you know, assign it maybe to somebody else, you know, schedule it for publication. But anyway, the one that we worked with, you know, had a lot of quirks. Like, for example, it didn't work with like any of the keyboard shortcuts on the platform that it was on. Like if you had a keyboard shortcut for Windows, it usually would not, like if you tried like something like Control K to do a link, it wouldn't work, and stuff like that. So just incredibly annoying. But And then it also had a terrible habit of, like, you know, you could lose content. Uh-huh. Like if you
I physically recoiled.
This made me think of, like, one time I saw somebody make an alignment chart of, like, how people compose, like, their writing. And I think writing directly in the CMS was, like, chaotic evil or something.
Chaotic, yeah.
what you should do instead is, like, I mean, the better practice was to write it somewhere else and then paste it into the CMS from there. And then, of course, for that, it sort of was fine. I mean, usually we went from, like, a Google Doc to this one, and then and of course it had a bespoke, like, highlighting system too. Like, it would highlight, you know, keywords in a certain color, and it would highlight, like, repetition in a color because repetition was back then was poison for SEO. So that was it was a pain to use. I mean, just because if it ever, like, went down or anything, then, like, everything, you know, ground to a halt.
Well, and our IT department was, like, one guy.
It was set up in such a way that, like, you could either be emailed to the client, or it would be published directly on their site, which sort of was a weird feeling.
I never had any of those clients. I think you have.
Yeah, it was sort of a thing they got away from over time. But in the beginning, like, it was common for some clients, they didn't even look at it. Like, they were just, that you could just go ahead and, you know, post it right to their site.
It was part of their contract. Like, they had to choose, like, do they want to review it for keys, or do they want to let you go willingly?
So it was, even learning the ins and outs of this was not useful in any way, because it wasn't transferable anywhere else. It was an adventure using it, and it sort of made me it made me look for sort of a simpler approach in my own writing. I used to blog at WordPress a lot, and the WordPress CMS was pretty, back then was kind of a mess, but then when I was a,
it's a lot yeah. now. I still use WordPress for my personal blog, and it's I actually have started writing in WordPress again, because it actually is decent at not eating my words.
Yeah, and then when I did get into Substack for a while, theirs was a little more streamlined. It was pretty easy to use because the keyboard shortcuts were all respected. It was pretty minimalistic, but then at the same time, you could easily do things like embed a video or embed a tweet or something. Like, you could just paste it and it would do all the formatting right there. So that was pretty easy. And then the one I have now, which is at micro.blog, is a little different because it's a static site generator, to go back to what we were talking about with static and dynamic. Basically you're just sending it a text file. It's pretty simple. Like, it doesn't require any a really heavy CMS or anything, because, like, you can literally do something like, you can do things like, you know, write it in a text editor or something, and then use a shortcut, like on a iOS or macOS, to, you grab the text from that text editor and then send it to, you know, the right API so that it gets published to your blog. So there's a lot of flexibility with that, and it's, like I said, it's pretty lightweight. And then using the Markdown is nice, because you can just do things like a single right bracket, and that's your block quote. You know, you don't have to do any sort of clicking around or anything. You know, because once it gets published, you know, it renders as a block quote. Or
so you're doing more like text that's formatting,
I mean, with something like micro.blog and using Markdown, I mean, you can do a lot of text manipulation and formatting really just using, you know, the Markdown syntax. So, like, a double asterisk for bold, underscore for italic. If you work with images and stuff, it's a little more complicated. So if I've ever had to do, like, an image, usually I'll use, like, the actual micro.blog app, or I'll use like Mars Edit, which on the desktop, which is Mars Edit is a is a text editor that you can compose in. You can connect it to like WordPress or Tumblr or micro.blog or any of those different blogging services, and it'll publish from there, because it's kind of an old school way of approaching it. But it's pretty lightweight blogging with a static site generator. But I guess it's the opposite of the content management system we had at the content mill, because
it's very much not a content mill. Like, I mean, you don't have nothing is saved to.
It's true. I mean, all the pieces that we wrote, I mean, the copies, such as they were, of what we written were either the original like Google Docs or, PDFs that we had saved after the fact from the web page, published web page, if it ever got that far, which it didn't always get that far, because I mean, there was, untold number of pieces that, just went to the ether. Either we never heard anything back, or, they just got kiboshed and that was it,
I can't even think about that. I wrote so much crap that I can't find anymore, like on the website or on the web in general.
Yep. Goodbye.
Bye. If I ever had to get a new job, it would not be from the pieces generated at that job.
Yeah, you'd have to. Well, one of the nice things about micro.blog is that you can set it up to default to back up your pages to the Internet Archive. It's I haven't actually done it though, because I'm always afraid I'll make some horrible mistake and then it'll be preserved forever. well, at least as long as the Internet Archive is around, which that's another thing too. But just the idea of having, like, it's sort of like those people are always digging up like the old Pitchfork.com reviews from like 25 years ago, like, because when Condé Nast bought Pitchfork, there were a bunch of old reviews were deleted, not all of them, but a lot of them were, and some of them were quite out there, and they're sort of very cringe to read now, they're all there on archive.org though. Like, if you just turn the clock back to, like, 2008 or something, they'll all still be there. So they even have, the site has been around so long that they even have, like, archives, of, I think, going back to, like, maybe the early 2000s or the late 90s. So, yeah, you can pull it up and see it as it was on, like, February of 2003 or something. So, yeah, it's a lot different now.
All right. Are we ready? All right. My third is optimization. And again, as a reminder, these are in order of how much rage they give me. So this one is middle of the pack. We can talk about it in terms of SEO or otherwise, right? Search engine optimization. Or as I was going through our former employer's website, they use it a lot to mean like optimized, like content that's been optimized for your audience.
Yeah.
And you have to write blogs that have been optimized for, your business. First of all, again, all of these words, what are they?
Right, yeah.
It's white noise at this
Well,
point.
What is it that does Wittgenstein would say meaning is use. Yeah, and that was a good, yeah. It's funny because when he started out his career, he thought that like words had sort of very scientific rigid meanings that you could be somehow like deduced. But then as he went on, he realized that basically all the meaning of the word comes from the way it's used. So because yeah. I mean, you can get it where like words evolve over time; they mean things that are quote unquote not supposed to. But basically the majority wins. I mean, if everybody agrees this means this, then that's what it means. So, optimization is one that it's funny.
It's such a good one. It kind of elicits like this, like if somebody says that in a meeting that I'm in now, either that or like optimize, you know, any of the iterations of it. Like, I'm just like, ew, like, like an immediate physical response. Like, why do we want to do that?
Yeah. I know. I think that my first experience with Optimize was actually under much happier circumstances. I think the game Final Fantasy VI, when you would go to your equip screen, there was a button that said Optimize, where you could you could, instead of having to go through and figure out what was the best like loadout for each character, you can just click Optimize and the only exceptions to it were the only times it would not give you the thing you might want was if there was some kind of weapon or armor that had like a variable stat. Like, for example, there was a weapon that would got more powerful the more HP you had. So it would never treat that as an optimized loadout, because there would always be one that would be better looking on paper, but then, you know, in practice, you know, this other one would be better because, you know, you could get it to where if you had like, you know, a ton of life, it'd be way more powerful than, you know, this other one, or some kind of, you know, weapon that had that you needed for a certain encounter or something that was weak to this weapon. But yeah, so it was, optimizes. I mean, that's the O in SEO. So search engine optimization. So, it's sort of like when you wonder, like, what content is for. A lot of times, it's like not even for a person; it's for a machine. I mean, it's being optimized for a thing that is not alive. So, I mean, like,
search engine optimization is literally you're creating words good for
Google. I know. It's like, why would you? It's like you're optimizing it, and then, in a way, it's sort of like, I don't know. How do you know that it's working? I mean, it's because it's sort of a black box on the other end.
Yes, that's always been my problem with SEO, right? Like, they tell us, make it a question, make your headlines a question, make your headlines a top fives, make your article has four keywords in the first 100 words, blah blah blah, all this, but like, why?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's sort of like, why was this, like, why, sort of like a, I don't know, it's sort of like a crafting recipe or something. Is like, why do I need two lead bars to make this item instead of like three or something? It's just somebody decided, you know, some point, like, you know, that's the cutoff, you know, needs three instead of four. And like,
it always just feels kind of arbitrary. And the thing that I don't know, the thing that really elicits kind of a physical response from me about this is that it's always about, well, like you were saying, this is exactly what you're saying, like, you're not optimizing anything. First of all, what does that mean? Second of all, you're not optimizing anything for a human.
Yeah, I mean, it not directly anyway. And yeah,
not directly,
so
right.
I mean, I had actually been reading, so I think I've brought this blog up before. It's a Substack by someone named Rob Horning, and he sort of writes a lot about LLMs and things. And so he wrote a recent one about, like, sort of the fiasco of Google Gemini, like Google's, you know, image generator. And some of the points here sort of overlap with what we've been saying about search engines. So he said something like, I don't think people care that much about things only they can see. I don't think aspirational solipsism is all that common, no matter how well refined the sales pitch for its quote-unquote convenience may be. Much of the pleasure of quote-unquote generating content, whether through a machine or by some other means, about oneself or about other things, or about other things as a way to signify oneself, is in imagining that someone else might also want it. So then, of course, the problem is, like, if you're generating this for a machine, you know, does the machine really want it? Does it appreciate it anyway? And I think that's part of, like, what makes, you know, content farming and content mill and all that, you know, sort of so dispiriting, that you kind of do feel like, you're just writing, you're just throwing something into the void. You don't have any expectation that it'll come back, that you'll get, you know, accolades for it or someone will like it. He goes on to say, you know, the content is not just for you to consume, but to anchor shared experience, or at least allow us to imagine its possibility. Content implies some eventual negotiation of intersubjectivity at some point, and even generative models, which can't negotiate any kind of subjectivity whatsoever, still produce content that serves that function once humans see it. So it was like, he'd gone on to say then that, you know, the people who were getting sort of upset about these images, like Google did, like images of like a black pope or like things like that. Mm-hmm. Of course, people
the Nazis, right? The something about a like black Nazis.
Yeah, and so it says that, you know, these people were says they understand the purpose of chatbots and generative models to be the ability to force other people to see a particular version of reality is a tool of power that masquerades as a tool of knowledge. So it's sort of like, I mean, the idea that these LLMs or, you know, search engines before them, the idea that they can sort of be a neutral dispenser of knowledge, you know, I mean, you definitely know that's false because, you know, you having worked at a content mill and fed it all of this content that is just complete garbage, and then it thinks it thinks all that's good.
None of that's objective, right? Like the stuff that we were writing it on the basis of a company putting it on their website so that people bought their product.
Yeah.
Right. And so like the objective, there is no objectivity. There is an article, and then throughout the article you write, this is why you need a good septic system. Like whatever, you know. And that's the idea that LLMs or like the content that can be generated by LLMs is objective in any way. Like,
yeah, we sort of can see that like on search engines, this is not objective because we know that like SEO is just riddled with all kinds of, scams and you know, different techniques that have been used to, you know, overwhelm any. I mean, you could write the best guide to, you know, I don't know, yard equipment ever, and it would still get swamped by like the ads and the, you know, the embedded videos and everything else, all the other types of content that would rank above it. And I mean, that's sort of like what this blog had been saying about how it's sort of a tool of power that's pretending to be a tool of knowledge. I think near the end, he had said something like, if you're willing to construe generative models as knowledge producers, as truth tellers, despite the obvious leaps of illogic it requires to think that, it must be because you really want to believe in the power to indoctrinate. And I mean, yeah, I mean, that really SEO is sort of a form of indoctrination because you're just swarming people with like, you know, this is the type of information you need and this is the exact format you need to consume it in, you know, it can. And then, But so I mean the last line I'll quote is that he says you have to be upset when they quote unquote fail so then you can pretend that they can succeed. You have to act like models make facts because you expect or crave the ability to force a quote unquote reality on others to make them adhere to your norms. So yeah, it's bleak. I mean, but it is. I mean, SEO is the same thing. It's sort of like, well, here's all the stuff you need to, like, you know, stick to. I mean, it is a form of indoctrination. So it's,
it seems kind of like an Ouroboros, right? Like, you're writing these articles because that's whatever you just said, right? Like, this is how you're supposed to consume content. We're saying this to readers on the internet, potential readers. This is how you're supposed to consume content. Therefore, those readers consume content that way. And then SEO is like, this is how you need to write the content so that the readers consume it. Right? Like, it's just
right, yeah, it is an Ouroboros. And it's like, the LLMs have taken that to just sort of an absurd scale. But then you get like, you know, they get fed with all these articles that are like, you know, listicles and, you know, breakdowns of different things. And then
how to optimize your data-driven
Then you take what they've regurgitated and you put it out there too. And then so then when they have to, you know, ingest new training material, they're training on the thing they've already given you. So it's sort of like, how's everything get better? Because, you know, it's just ingesting it, you know, it is like a snake eating its own tail.
man, every time we have this conversation, it's like,
yeah,
we did this. We did this to the internet. All right. Number three.
See, so for me, I think this is one that's a little more, it's not super specific to content generation, but it came up all the time anyway. Best practices.
Yes.
This is always a curious one for me because, I mean, there's really no such thing as like, I mean, I don't know. You would never say worst practices. You would never say good practices or better. It's always best. So it's sort of like something that is,
bad practices.
I mean, you're sort of assuming that whatever the problem is, it's already sort of been solved in a way. So you have these best practices that are, you know, the peak of the form. And then it's sort of, I don't know, it always gets, it's very heavy handed, you know, the way they'll always say, well, it's best practice to make your, you know, snippet X number of characters long, or it's best practice, you know, to put the keyword in the headline, you know, three or four times. I mean, it's sort of a,
Well, it's always changing, right? Like, it's best practice to use three keywords in the headline. It's best practice, actually, to use a keyword phrase in the headline. Actually, it's best practice to not use any keywords, but use keywords in the first line of the thing.
Yeah, it's a funny term, too, just because you don't really see practice being plural like that very much. Because usually, and it's sort of a... You think of practice more as something that's sort of like a rehearsal, but then the way it's used in this sense is that it's something that is sort of real, and it's as if the whatever the situation is, you know, here are all the solutions to that. And I think
what's the etymology of that, right? Like practice is like practicum, which is like what, activity or something?
So as far as like as far as like best practices as usage goes, I don't know when that really sort of took off, but a practicum is like study for. I mean, in English, it means, you know, it's study that's designed for like preparing a, you know, a teacher or a doctor or something for a for a a real world situation. Like so, but so it's kind of odd, you know, that it's taken instead this meaning where it's sort of like, it's a different meaning of the word where it's sort of like it's something you do instead of something you study. Yeah. And, practice does come, it is a Latin word, so it sort of does mean something that is practical. I think, you know, the way best practice sort of works is that it often forecloses any sort of dispute. So it's sort of like if you had any sort of idea about like, well, maybe we should do it some other way. And best practice does not allow any sort of wiggle room there. So because, I mean, they're the best. Right. So, so it's sort of like it's prejudged to be the winner sort of.
Also, you know what I find interesting about this conversation we're having is that you are using best practices as a plural, and I am saying best practices as like a compound singular now.
Yeah.
Almost like on accident, right? Like I'm not meaning to do that, but best practices is, right? I mean, but it doesn't sound incorrect to me. Like, I don't know. I don't know if that means anything, but it's sort of like that kind of both of those
like Americans and
valid.
Like sometimes Americans and British make different. They have different rules for plural and singular. Like I know in the UK, sometimes they'll say that a band are something, whereas in the US, it's the band is. Because I think they're treating it as a collective group, and like all the the people are like
or a collective. Yeah,
you know, like the people are acting in tandem, but you know, there's multiple people, so you have to use a plural, make that plural, whereas in the U.S. it's more common to say, you know, the United States is, you know, even though there's states that, you would think that Yeah, it would be like...
Right. I have heard people say United States are, but I want to say that that's like something that not people from the United
States... Yeah, I think there might be something that it was more common maybe before the Civil War. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think that somebody made like a stump speech about that once, about how it was, you know, after the Civil War became the United States is instead of the United States are. But I do think it's also an Atlantic thing where it was more common to... Well, the United States is, I mean, yes, it has the S in it, but I guess from the UK thing, it's more like, you know, here's a, like a, you know, the council are, you know, or the, you know, the, because the council has multiple people in it, but in the US, sort of like, well, that's just one unit, though, that's acting as a unit, so.
Sorry for that.
Oh, no.
Grammatical diversion. I just thought it was interesting.
It's funny because, I mean, you know, the best practice.
We're talking
about practices of plural, of making plurals, yeah. So,
yeah.
I mean, it sort of shows how, in a way, that the idea that you can have a definitive answer to everything is, I mean, at least, I mean, okay, so you can have a definitive answer, I guess, to things that, like, you know, is this the best medicine that we have available for this particular condition?
In the
yeah, but then, like, when you're talking about content, I mean, yeah, you're talking about content marketing, though, I mean, you're getting pretty nebulous. I mean, you're talking about... I mean, I feel that really wants to seem scientific, and but then, like I said, that you're sort of contending with a black box on the other end. So, to the extent that you can understand what's going on, you know, it's only by reverse engineering. So, I mean, yeah, and you can. I mean, there are people who are very good at this, but you know, it's not solved in a way that, like, say, I don't know, like, you know, this medicine treats. You know, provides pain relief, you know, that's, you know, something like that, or but anyway,
it is a physical reality.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Right. Instead of like the reality being of, if you use best practices in your content, more people will read your article on Google. Like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I just feel like, you know, you're gonna get to some point where you'll be like, but I followed all the best practices and nobody read my thing, you know? It's like, so it's sort of like,
yep.
And so then, yeah, the way the term best practices works, then it's sort of like it shifts the blame onto you because, well, we already figured out that these are the best. So the fact they didn't work for you, you know, that's on you. Sort of, yeah.
That's your fault. Yeah. Okay. So my fourth item is brand / personal brand, either brand or personal brand, mostly personal brand, because I used to work at the business school, and the amount of times that someone, just like a random person in the hallway, would be talking about having a personal brand, and this was back in like 2016, you know, like the number of times I heard the phrase, I need to improve my personal brand. Do you have your personal brand on LinkedIn? What's your personal brand? Like, the amount of times I heard that phrase, it's completely lost all meaning.
Yeah, it's
and you know, the branded content. Yeah. You have you know, the brand of the of the company. Like, which is funny because at my job, I am technically a brand ambassador for the. Which basically means that I get all the JPEGs of the logos, and people have to come and ask me to use the JPEG.
Like the sacred artifacts or something.
The sacred artifacts, yes. So, you know, I think it's funny because I've kind of started using the phrase, you know, personal brand, like kind of ironically.
Yeah.
When somebody mentioned something like, oh, I saw a cat today, I'll say something like, oh, my personal brand is on point because you told me that. Like, you know, and
I know. It's I don't think I've ever used it in a way that I wasn't like sort of smirking while I was using it.
Right.
I think it's like, you know, that's they'll say, you know, hey, let's go out to this bar or something. I'm like, well, that's not really my brand, you know. And you know, it's like bar hopping is not my brand, you know. And then, I mean, it has a weird origin because, I mean, we're talking about things like, you know, like cattle, you know, they have like those hot irons, they brand them, you know, with, or a similar things like that, where you're making some kind of mark to like establish that something belongs to you. So,
yeah.
And then you hear things like, you know, brand equity and, or brand, I mean, like you'll say like this brand has, you know, is worth X amount of dollars or something. And this is funny because of everything we talked about with like data driven and so on. It's like, I mean, how can you quantify how much like the Apple logo is worth, you know? Like, I mean, that's really, right. really kind of grasping at straws there. I mean, but it also shows that like, you know, a lot of this stuff is extremely subjective because I mean, it's there's no objective. I mean, cause I mean, why is like the Coca-Cola logo so valuable? You know, I mean, you can't break right. it down and say, well, it's, you know, it's because it has, it's X number of inches wide and you know, it has this color. Yeah.
The kerning.
Yeah. It's just like, yeah. I mean, you couldn't break it down. If you broke it down to all the facts about it, it would not, the totality of those facts would not add up to whatever you were looking for. So,
like the real answer to that question is because lots of people buy Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, and I don't know. We do a lot at my job about brands, and so the way that the university is structured, like I am on a team that is based in a different division, but we also have like an entire division based on like marketing and communication of the school, you know. And we are always doing workshops about brand recognition. What does our brand mean? What do people think about when they think about our brand? And I'm like, I don't know, we're a school and our colors are this. Like, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I'm being purposefully obtuse about it, but like, I seriously cannot handle when people talk to me seriously about
the brand. Yeah, I feel like a lot of the stuff about the brand is, I mean, there's a lot going on there, but one thing is it's like marketing and data people are trying to like basically intrude on the domain of like artists. So it's sort of like, the idea that like an artist could come up with something that would be incredibly valuable is just like, they can't really, that doesn't sit well for some reason. They have to think it's like, well, it's not because they drew something that looked good and people liked the colors of it. It's because of the, you know, the perception and the, and you know, the way.
It was this particular color that like made their eyes go to the, whatever, like everything has to
be broken down to some kind of, in some kind of science or something that can be like,
everything has to
data
be
description. Yeah. It's like best practice.
Oh my God. At the end, I think we should come up with a sentence with all of our words in it. But yeah, so I don't know. It's
or just, like,
I hate saying stuff like this because I know I'm good friends with a lot of people in the marketing department. I just, the brand conversation really, I don't know how else to tell them that I don't care about this thing.
It's not your brand to care about brands. Yeah.
It's really not.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
And the only time I've really ever heard it used in sort of a negative way that I can think of, and I'm sure there's others, but someone will say something is like a store brand of something, you know, like the, like if something is like an inferior, like I remember there was some politician who ran for like governor of New York a while back, and he was Republican. And he, of course, got beaten by a lot, and someone referred to him as the store brand Donald Trump. And I was like, yeah, sort of like, you know, you get Coca-Cola, and then on the other hand, you have like, you know, I don't know, Sam's Choice, whatever, like Walmart used to have like Sam's Choice or something, or, you know, that was.
Here it's Big K.
Yeah.
It's Kroger.
And I'm trying to think of like Costco, they just sell straight up Coca-Cola there. But, or like there used to be one, I think Walmart had Dr. Thunder, that was there, Dr. Pepper, and Mountain Lightning was, of course, their Mountain Dew. But
So like you have the connotation is that it's lesser than the real quote unquote one.
Yeah, I know. It is funny. Yeah.
I think maybe me picking this word was a little bit of peeking behind the curtain of my current frustrations at my job, just because they are also becoming a little more stringent about us using the brand. And you have to get everything like approved and all this.
For some reason, like, I just keep cracking up whenever I think about brand equity for some reason, because it's like something you can like trade, and like it has like a, you know, or you could invest in it.
That has a monetary value. Yeah.
It goes up and down, you know. Yeah. I mean, I think they wish it was sort of like that, but I mean,
yeah.
Anyway, for sure. This might be my last one because I think some of the other ones I'd listed down we've basically sort of covered in some other shape or form. But it's a little bit of a different attack. It fits sort of thematically, although it's a little bit of a different domain, but downloadable content. So this is, or as we all know it, DLC, which this is a good case of where like sort of the acronym has become detached from the underlying meaning because it's just sort of like now it's sort of like, you have any sort of add-on to a game that comes on, there's always DLC, and then nobody really thinks about what it really means. And so...
this is actually a good segue. Maybe we should do an episode, another episode about video game content, but anyway.
Yeah, so I as far as I can tell, this word sort of became common in, like, the 2000s. I would say the Xbox 360 was sort of the, what would you say, the Mayflower of the downloadable content usage.
Now, wait, hold on. I have to write that down. Alex says the Xbox is okay.
So the Xbox 360 launched in 2005. So it was actually a full year before any of the other seventh generation consoles, namely the PlayStation 3 and the Nintendo Wii, came out. And so the Xbox 360, I mean, most of its games were, you know, on DVDs, but it also had, you know, sort of these DLC, which you could get from, like, the Xbox, I think it was called, I've never really been much of an Xbox person, so I don't really know the ins and outs of all the terminology, but I think it's Xbox Live Arcade. You could download, like, these games, and they only existed as physical downloads like this. They weren't, you know, they wouldn't have, like, a physical version, so those were downloadable content, and then there was also, you know, this notion of you could have like a base game, and then you could have different add-ons that would get, you know, put onto it as it over time, sort of like a I think they began calling them like a wave or a season, you know, or like if you got access to all the DLC, you'd be called like a season pass. That's a term that I think Ubisoft has used, and then so I mean I think when you're this term, so I mean, downloadable content, like, I think before that, I mean, you wouldn't really call, like a game that only existed, like, on a cartridge or a disc, like, I think it's a lot harder to call that content, because it doesn't have the, I mean, I think the word content, as I've sort of, blogged about before, it has sort of a contradictory meaning. It means something like, something on the one hand that can be, sort of contained in a discrete way, that's discrete ETE instead of EET. But at the same time, it's also sort of continuous, sort of like there's no end to it. It's always flowing. It's dynamic. Definitely. So it's sort of like it's both dynamic and static at the same time. And I'm just trying to dig up. So I said something like, it's sort of like it's like the person who is, you know, selling content or making money off of it sees it as sort of a continuous thing, but then the person who is sort of tasked with actually making it or consuming it sort of sees it as a discrete thing. So it's sort of like two different, so like the person who owns, I mean, the content, like in this case, like the downloadable content, I mean, it's coming from you know, like a centralized platform, so like either like the Xbox, PlayStation, or Steam, or any of the digital storefronts. So those are all sort of, you know, containers in the sense that, you know, the content it can only be gotten from that container. Like, you can't get it anywhere else. I mean, so that's sort of the, but then there always has to be sort of, so, I mean, in that sense, it is sort of discrete because, you know, you're like, well, that's the only place it is right there. You can pin it down to that exact source. You know, it doesn't come from anywhere else. But then the others at the same time, it's sort of like, well, this is never ending. We can just keep adding, you know, more to it, and it doesn't really matter if it's broken or if it has a lot of bugs in it, or if nobody wants it. It's just sort of like, you know, digital distribution makes so that you can just keep, like, you know, for example, like how many updates has, you know, Minecraft gotten over the years? I mean, I think it's still like being, I mean, that's not a, what I would call maybe literal DLC.
The Sims is what.
Yeah, the Sims has, right. And then, or like the 2D Minecraft, Terraria had, I think it got like DLC mm-hmm. for like 8 or 9 years after it was released. I think they finally did just stop doing like major updates. But yeah, so.
You know, it brings to mind like the Cyberpunk 2077 game and how buggy it was when it came out. But they were like banking on, you know, there being bug fixes and everything. Like there was DLC that fixed all of the stuff. And so it felt like the developers didn't really have to make it perfect.
I mean, so downloadable content does allow, it does allow for sort of a redemption arc in a way for a game, in a way that like in the past.
In kind of a shitty way, though, because often you have to pay.
Yeah, DLC is that's a good point. DLC is basically never free. I mean, every now and then, I mean, you might find something that's like, you know, a minor sort of little extra level or two, or that might be free, or it might be included in some kind of bundle. It is common, I forget, after a while, they might, you know, like, for example, like the Nintendo Switch finally got the Batman Arkham games late last year, including all the DLC. So in the past, that would have all required a separate, you know, payment. It is, like you said, it's almost always paid. So it's sort of like it's a way to keep making money from the game. And although it's, I mean, I think that when the Xbox, the seventh generation came out, I mean, this is a pretty novel strategy that you could get money, you know, sort of for selling additions to an existing game, or you know, selling games that, you know, that were digital only, you know, making them much easier to buy than having to like actually have something shipped to you or go to a store. But then in a way, this model is sort of, I don't know if it's passe, because I mean, now, I mean, of course you have, you know, microtransactions really took off, you know, in the 2010s. And then you have games that like, you know, subscription services like Game Pass and so on. But I mean, downloadable content, I mean, it's the idea that you can make, it's pure capitalism, because it's sort of like we can make, I mean, like, for example, like Elden Ring is getting some DLC that costs $40. So it's like basically, it's like buying a whole game, basically. And I was just thinking of one of my old blog posts I'd written, I'd quoted that thing about Bill Gates had said, like, 1996, where he said that the internet allows material to be duplicated at low cost, no matter the size of the audience. The internet also allows information to be distributed worldwide at basically zero marginal cost to the publisher. So they're able to distribute this, you know, DLC, since it is downloadable, it doesn't really, it's something you can get, you know, just over a network. You'll have to like go and, physically buy like an extra cartridge or disc or something. Although, like I said, sometimes like a deluxe edition or a, you know, anniversary edition will include all the DLC on the disc or cart. I think that quote does overlook something else. So is it like, I mean, yeah, the distribution costs are basically zero, but then the development costs are quite significant often, especially with like modern like AAA games, there's something I saw, like it's like the average, you know, I mean, like, you know, AAA games take so long to develop now, it's almost like a whole console life cycle can pass from their start to finish. So it's like that.
I mean, a Zelda was
The Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Like, I mean, somebody said like the PlayStation 5 is already like, you know, 4 years old, and this game has been in development since, you know, before it was even, you know, released. And so and somebody, the creator of Final Fantasy VI, said that, you know, if they ever tried to do the same thing with that game, it would take like, I think he said it would take like 20 years or something to do it, because there's so many characters and you would need so many, people to work on it. So downloadable content, it's sort of the point. I mean, once that term came into vogue, it's sort of like, well, games are now sort of they've joined the realm of like, you know, online articles
it does feel that
like
way
other stuff that's seen as content, because I always thought there was kind of a curve with like the way that, I mean, you know, like text and music often are very easy to sort of, I think, I mean, they were sort of the first things that sort of became sort of really embedded in the digital domain. And video, like movies took longer, and then games have taken the longest of all, because like, you know, people, you know, at some point people stopped buying like lots of magazines and newspapers, but then that probably happened before they stopped buying like, you know, physical music. And then, you know, physical movies and TV shows lasted longer than that. And then physical games have outlasted even that. Because, like, I mean, like in some countries, like in Japan, physical games are still like a super majority of all purchases. Although I think in the U.S. they're maybe like half or less now. But, yeah, so downloadable content is sort of like, this is where games enter the content machine. You know, they're never finished anymore. It's sort of like you can always keep tacking on things to them and upselling people on, like, you know, a separate skin or a separate, you know, map or something.
Like, part of me is like, yeah, if I really love a game, I want to play it forever. Yeah. But the other part of me is like, wait, I finished that game 3 years ago. What do you mean I have to buy something else?
I think I did that with Fire Emblem. Like, I finished Fire Emblem Three Houses, and then, like, some DLC came out, and I still haven't finished it, like, you know, 4 years later. Because
that's how I felt about the Xenoblade DLC. Like, it took me, like, a year. There's just, I have so many other things to do. This is an entirely separate conversation. But, like, but what you're saying, you know, is that by using the term downloadable content, video games have kind of entered that space where we consider them as, like, living documents.
Right, yeah. Really. Things that can be sort of optimized and tweaked. And I mean, because, I mean, it's true even on a very mundane level, because, like, it used to be, like, you know, once a game came out as a physical thing, it was done. And, like, whatever, the way it ran, everything, that was, you couldn't improve it or make it worse in any way. Now you can. And so that has sort of, I mean, to go back, so, like, it does go with your thing about optimized. So now, like, the idea that you can optimize a game for hardware is much more of an ongoing concern, because, you know, back in the day, like, you had one chance to optimize it. That was when you were before you released it. And now it's sort of like it's a continuous process, in the same way that, like, you can go back and do an old SEO article and refresh it, you know, re-optimize it.
And I just wonder what that does to dev cycles, right? Like, what does that do? Anyway, this is a whole other thing. Okay, I have one more word, and I guess that's probably our last word, because you said that one was your last. Okay. This one is the one that gives me the most rage when I read it in terms of, like, content or, like, voice or, like, brand recognition. It's the word authentic.
Authentic, okay, yes.
Because, first of all, as I've said for literally every other word on my list, what does that mean? What does the word authentic mean? In general, it means, like, real or, like, truthful, or like the one true thing, or, like, you know, it in general, something that is known to be in reality.
Right.
It's the authentic version of whatever. It's the only real version of whatever.
It's so it's funny that so there's a couple of angles I thought about that too. Like, first of all, is like the overlap with, you know, the word for, like, signing into a system. So, like, you authentication.
You're the one true.
And so person. I always think of so it's funny because people use, when they say authentic, like, oh, this is authentic, you know, such and such cuisine, or this is an authentic, you know, voice or whatever. It sort of sees a positive thing. But then, like, authentication for, like, you know, signing into, like, I don't know, Office 365 is often kind of an adversarial experience, because it's sort of like, your password is wrong, or your password is expiring, or you need to, you know, use it two or three extra factors.
Select every feature looks like a motorcycle.
And so it's a very, it's sort of like the onus is always on you to prove that you are who you really are. So I'd also seen something about how, about authenticity, about someone had talked about cooking, and he said that there was a structural problem with cooking, because He said, people are literally afraid of cooking. Often what is called learned helplessness has been deliberately engineered. Everything about food culture is oriented toward perfectionism, optimization, authenticity, and getting things exactly right. It's like a computer trying to cook. But the world of cooking is wildly variable and relies on the cultivation of intuition. No wonder people are afraid. Like many aspects of contemporary American life, cooking culture is a structurally obsessive compulsive. He used all my words.
Praised up.
And it's funny because that was just written literally today. You have this OCD drive. Like, you know, there is one, like, there is literally a best practice for cooking. And, like, that's the only way you can do it.
Your best practice word and my authentic word. I mean, like, it's kind of on the similar vein, right? Like, you are saying that this is an authentic cook, you know, an authentic cuisine. This is, well, first of all,
yeah, like, that one, what that, that what one often gets me too, because people often, I mean, there's like all discourse you can do about like how, you know, authentic Italian food, like how much Italian food was actually invented, like either in the U.S. or within like the last like 50 years. But then people will act like it's some kind of age old recipe because they think that somehow makes it more real in a way that, like, you know, hey, tiramisu is invented like in the 20th century, you know, it's not that, it's not, or, you know, what was it? Carbonara is like, wasn't invented in the U.S., you know, so that was considered like inauthentic because they're not quote unquote really Italian. But what is it? What does it mean to be from Italy? Because Italy didn't exist for 1861. You can really go into like an Inception type thing here where you're losing sort of the boundaries and, you know, everything seems like it's up for grabs. Yeah.
And usually, like, in terms of content marketing, it's used as a positive, you know. They're saying, like, you want to give your pieces an authentic voice. Or, I mean, again, I'm voicing a little bit of discontent in the place where I work, but they're always talking about giving our brand an authentic voice. And, like, what does that mean? I mean, well, for us, it means it sounds like our social media posts come from a student.
Yeah.
Right? But, like, first of all, that's not happening.
Yeah. Well, it's like what I've been quoting from that article where it's like you have to pretend that these machines can fail. So, I mean, you have to act that they can fail so you can pretend that they can succeed. So it's sort of like you have to act like, well, there's an inauthentic way for something that won't pass muster of the machine, and then here's the one that will. How does Google know what's authentic? Because, I mean, authenticity is one of those things where it is sort of just like a vibe or an aesthetic. And I don't think a machine is very well prepared to evaluate that. So,
and it's so subjective too, because like what's authentic for me, like a writer in my 30s, is different from what's authentic for an 18-year-old, you know. And I don't know. And like we can follow this line of thinking down the line, and it at the end of the line, like, it really just is like every other word on my list, it just becomes white noise, right? In the background of when you say that this thing needs to be authentic, I'm like, yeah, cool, I'm just gonna do it. I don't know what you mean by that, but I'm going to do it. And you know what? You're probably going to tell me that it sounds authentic.
Yeah.
Because that's like the buzzword that people use for these kind of things.
I mean, it's sort of like, if you take the route of trying to compare it to, you know, computer authentication, it's somehow supposed to mean that, like, you know, this shows who you really are. It's sort of that, I mean, I think that's sort of, especially with any sort of writing or creative work, that's often, I don't know if this is the right term. I mean, it's like a category error, or it's just a mistake to think about it, that you can tell who someone is by, like, the type of work they do or the type of art they make. I mean, that's sort of part of it, part of them. But, I mean, a lot of that is also, it might be affect. It might be imitating something else. I mean, part of that is an authentic, I mean, it might be authentically them in some way. In other ways, it's not. It's something they got from somebody else. And I think it's sort of, I think the obsession with authenticity is is something about, I mean, it's the idea that, like, you know, it's sort of, it's very, in my opinion, it's very individualistic. It's the idea that people can, every person can have a totally original and, you know, breakthrough voice. And I don't know if that's really the case, because, I mean, so much of everything is just sort of listening to other, I mean, I don't know. I think I thought this before, like, I wish more people, when they thought of, like, oh, what does it mean to be a smart person or a genius? I think, oh, it's somebody who's sitting alone thinking of great ideas. And I think really in reality, it's more like this person is going out and seeing something somebody else did and said, hey, this gives me an idea, you know? And so it's...
Right. You're not creating.
Yeah, and it's, I think, I mean, people will beat themselves up and say, oh, I wish I'd thought of that. And I'm like, well, you know, you probably couldn't have thought of it. You had to see it somewhere else first. You had to have some kind of catalyst. I mean, if you were just sitting around, it wouldn't occur to you to, like, you know, invent the iPhone or something, you know, and like,
again, we live in a society. People have different skills. Like, we watch people do different things. Like, what's authentic for me is different for another person. Like, I think that there's something.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I thought of this recently too, but like, they made the, like, live action, Avatar, The Last Airbender.
On my list.
Because there's really a weird history with this, because, I mean, the show is, I mean, originally it was a cartoon. Some people debated whether or not it's an anime. I mean, because it is kind of an anime style, but it's not really from Japan. So, like, is it authentic anime? And then also, so that's one thing about it. You know, is it authentic anime? And the other thing is, you know, there was some consternation once over, like, how I think they made a movie of it in 2010, and it was like,
An M. Night Shyamalan,
yeah, and there was some consternation over the casting, like the racial makeup of the casting. Like, one of them was, there were some white actors and some Indian actors, and, you know, different backgrounds and so on. And I think the complaint was that the cast should have all been, like, East Asian descent. And then when they made this new one, I mean, they basically all, I mean, the cast was overwhelmingly, East Asian, but it's sort of a weird space, I think, because, I mean, first of all, the characters are all cartoons, and, you know, their original voice actors were from all kinds of different backgrounds. The show's creators were white. I mean, there's really a lot of different, you know, complex things going on there. And then, and of course, so it's like, I mean, why would you think it could only be authentic if these cartoon characters who were drawn as, like, you know, sort of, I mean, their skin color is sort of white, is sort of white, not, yeah. I mean, but why would you immediately jump to thinking they had to be only of this background when turned into real life people?
Right. Well, and there's the added, like, bit of, like, is it authentic? Is it an authentic, you know, remake of the show? Because the other one apparently was a disaster for whatever plot.
Yeah. I think it was a fake Onion meme where there was a legendary Onion article after Bill de Blasio left office in New York and Eric Adams took over, and, like, so people were always complaining when Bill de Blasio was mayor, and then when Eric Adams came in, he was if anything much worse, and the article title is well, not so easy to find a mayor who doesn't suck shit, huh, or something like that. Like, and the actual text of the article is just like you know, literally laugh out loud funny, but that headline, but then they changed it to M. Night Shyamalan, well, not so easy to make a live action Avatar that doesn't suck shit. Like, that was a good one. And it brought up those sort of authenticity questions. And yeah, I mean, there's different perspectives on that, but it's sort of like, well, and of course, having anything that has, like, a huge fandom is, like, the worst possible forum to try and, like, adjudicate those type of issues. So,
well, I think
yeah, that's pretty good. We've got, like, because we came at it from different angles, but then it all overlapped. So,
sure.
It was
cool. Fun. I think this was a good one to kind of get back.
For sure, yeah. It feels good, dude, to get this one down.
we'll probably be doing some more book club type stuff in the near future as well. So,
for sure.
So, all right. Well, I guess I will start off our promos. I'm Liz, as you know. I blog and stream and such at lizcultivates.com. I've been doing a lot of Twitch streaming recently. My community is raising money this month for Gamers Outreach, which is an organization that provides gaming devices and like entertainment equipment to kids in hospitals. So check that out. Go to the website. And yeah, that's it.
Yeah, so I'm Alex, and I have a website at content-lab.agency. So that's my blog. And then the podcast itself is hosted at literally.party. And there's a there's a bunch of buttons there where you can, if you're not already subscribed to it, you can easily find the show and all the major podcast clients and services. So like Apple and Spotify and so on. So pretty easy. Yeah.
And if you get a chance, leave us a review. I mean, I would love to hear what people think about content and hear what people think about our favorite words. I think it would be really cool to kind of have a back and forth about that.
Yeah, so, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I know we have some regular listeners, so so that's cool. Well, hopefully our next episode will be a lot sooner than this one was. Anyway, thanks for putting up with our long gap here, but we finally got 2024 off on the right foot. So,
yes.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well,
thanks for listening, and we will catch you later. All right. Bye.
Bye.